You're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM radio in New Haven. We're streaming live at newhavenindependent.org. This is The Table Underground, and I'm your host, Tegan Engel. We cover inspiring stories of food, people, radical love, and creative social justice. For today's show, we're meeting with people from an inspiring new food business that opened recently in New Haven, Connecticut. Junzi Kitchen is run by a talented team of people who are bringing Northern Chinese cuisine and an innovative business model to the United States, and New Haven is their first stop. Today's guests are Chef Lucas Sin from Junzi Kitchen and Marketing Director Reed Immer. Lucas was raised in Hong Kong. He apprenticed in kitchens in Japan, Hong Kong, and the USA, and he came to New Haven to attend Yale University, where he graduated in 2015. Reed Immer was raised in Connecticut. He attended UConn, and after working on marketing campaigns for national brands, he joined Junzi Kitchen, and he's been spearheading marketing and the innovative night lunch series. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming today.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
Hello. So you guys have this great new restaurant downtown, and you are featuring a kind of Chinese food that we don't really see much of in this country. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing that's a little different than other Chinese restaurants?
Yeah. So at Junzi, mostly we do these two things called bings and noodles. Bings and noodles originate from northern China, which is a specific type of Chinese food that you don't get in the United States very much. Most of the United States Chinese food is dominated by foods that are derivative of Hunan and Cantonese cuisine. So that's like the spicy thing, that's the wok thing. Heavy on your aromatics, garlic, ginger, and scallions. However, northern Chinese food is rooted more in wheat. So we don't eat very much rice in northern China. Which explains the primary carbohydrates within the food that we serve at Junzi are bings, which are sort of like flat. They're sort of like flatbreads that have no yeast in them that we roll ingredients into. And then noodles are sort of basically cut up bings, but they're
right,
strands of wheat that are cooked
so
in
wheat
water.
Is the base, not rice. Is that because
Absolutely.
Rice doesn't grow as well in northern China?
Yeah, because it's a lot colder.
But
that's not to say that rice isn't in northern China. It did come up with the trade routes. But there are interesting sort of like manipulations of how those grains are mixed when they come up to northern China.
Okay.
For instance, rice, you don't really quite eat rice alone that often. You mix it in with millet. You mix it in with whatever other type of wheat berries or whatnot. That sort of make it sort of like more hearty, like warmer type of thing than you would in Cantonese cuisine.
Okay. So the Chinese food that a lot of Americans are used to in the 40,000 plus Chinese restaurants in this country, that's kind of soy sauce, ginger, garlic, kind of heavier, salty, sweet, spicy.
Yeah.
That's a sort of different cuisine than the northern cuisine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's probably to do with, I mean, food moves with the people.
Right.
And so the first immigrants in America from China were from those regions. They came through the south where a lot of the ports were. They started working on the railroads and they started making all this food. And then they slowly made their way all over towards east from California to the rest of the United States. And so there's this crazy network that of Chinese people making a very, very similar type of food, no matter where they're come by the time you're in like the mid-20th century. So what we're doing is, I suppose it is a little weird, but our format is also quite weird.
I think it tastes delicious, not weird, but I'm kind of asking you about it because I think people in this country think Chinese food and they think, oh, we know it all. But
right. In
fact, it's a huge country with tons of different cuisines.
Absolutely,
and part of what you're doing is bringing in this really specific piece of northern Chinese cuisine. Give us, before we get into the details of the food, give us a little idea of kind of what is Junzi Kitchen in terms of how the restaurant works.
So Junzi Kitchen, during the day you're going to walk into this sort of like white restaurant, and then you'll see an assembly line not dissimilar to the one we find at Chipotle. So let me start with the carbohydrate. You put your proteins on, and then your vegetables, and then your pickles and your sauce and that sort of thing. So in that sense, as a Chinese restaurant in America, to me, it seems quite American. It's a very sort of American way of eating things puts forward choice and puts forward like diversity and colors and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So that's basically what we do.
Yeah.
That said, things get a little weirder on weekends and the nights and things. We like to do a lot of pop-ups. We do a lot of things that fall into the sort of like night lunch series where on Fridays and Saturdays we do sort of a more American Chinese type of Chinese food.
Right.
Almost to honor the fact that we are a Chinese restaurant in America, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah. So we will definitely talk more about that. But you brought in some food for us today. And you sort of just glossed over a little bit. And Reed, please jump in here. So I'm opening up here a Bing. So as you said, at Jin Zi Kitchen, it's sort of set up Chipotle style, which I think some people are familiar with. The first thing you do is you pick your Bing, which is either a whole wheat or a white wheat crepe-like wrap, or you pick your noodles, and you have two kinds of noodles, right? You have a...
Yeah, spring noodles are skinny like spaghetti, and then knife noodles are a little wider.
Okay. And then you're picking your protein. So give us some examples of what the proteins are that you have here.
So most of our protein is braised. The beef is a traditional beef recipe that's braised, and then it sits overnight, and then you slice up real thin. Mm-hmm. The pork is sort of like pulled. It's a pork shoulder mixed with a little bit of pork hock. And the chicken is just like grilled with a sort of five spicy type of Chinese seasoning.
And then I think you also have tofu.
Yeah, and actually my favorite
mushrooms.
Two proteins are tofu and mushroom.
Me too.
Yeah, the tofu is seared, and actually the first thing that the tofu is the reason why the tofu holds such a dear spot in my heart is because the sauce for the tofu was the first thing we worked on with Eva, who's the other chef at Gen Z. And so the two of us came up with this recipe that's derivative of, honestly, a Northern Chinese way of cooking seafood. We sort of made it vegetarian, and we started glazing our tofu with it, and it gets crispy on both sides and soft inside and stuff. So it's sort of absolutely wonderful. And the mushrooms are king oyster mushrooms, which most people don't use in Chinese restaurants, where button mushrooms are favored. But king oyster mushrooms have a little bit of chew on them. And if they're stir-fried properly with the correct number or amount of aromatics, it gets kind of nice.
Yeah, those are actually my most favorite thing in the restaurant is those mushrooms. They're exceptional. So you pick your mushroom, you pick your protein, but before your protein, you're actually picking your sauce, right?
The sauce for the noodles, yeah.
Yeah, for the noodles. So what are the sauce choices?
The sauces are designed to be based off of this Chinese, this Northern Chinese way of eating noodles called dalumian, which is a sort of wet noodle. So it's tossed in sauce, so it's not dry, but it's not soupy, which is how most noodles is eaten in southern China. So we have three sauces. The first sauce is a jiajia sauce, which is derivative of this thing in Beijing. It's called the Beijing dish. It's called jiajiamian. And so it's sort of a bunch of fermented soybeans that are ground up and deep fried and that sort of thing.
So that's your super salty.
Yeah, that's our salty sort of like dark sauce.
Yeah.
And then we have a tomato scallion sauce that's more referent to sort of countryside flavors. And that's tomatoes and eggs, cornstarch to thicken it as a slurry, and then it's got an egg drop in it. Mm. And the last one is honestly our most popular sauce. It's furu sesame. Most people like it because of the sesame component, but the furu is actually a fermented tofu paste that brings in a lot of sort of like umami flavor into the sauce as well. So those are three sauces that you start off with.
Great. So let's take a look at this bowl you have here. I think we have to taste this. So we have a gorgeous bowl here. I'll have to post some pictures online, but I think this is a hand-cut noodle bowl. And this one, on top of the noodles and the meat, we have some pickled daikon and carrot and some scallions. And what's this little black stuff on top here?
That's chivash, which is honestly a mistake that somehow has stayed on the menu. It's basically Chinese chives, which is part of sort of the garlic family. We're making a confit out of them, and then they burnt. It got kind of ashy, and we kept it on the menu because honestly, it gives it a little bit of a smoky garlic flavor that we didn't really quite expect.
Cool.
It's quite nice.
So this isn't some traditional Chinese ingredient. This was a creative mistake.
It's a Junzi blunder that's stayed with us.
Wonderful. All right, I'm going to take a little taste here. Oh, it's delicious. So this one has the tomato sauce on it, yeah? So I haven't actually tasted that before. One of the things I love about this is the vinegariness of the pickles. which balances so nicely with the kind of fattiness of the meat or whatever protein you have, and then the kind of meatiness of the noodles and the starch. I think it's the vinegar, the sour balance with the salt is delicious, and it feels so much lighter. Like when we think of Chinese food, it is often heavy, the Chinese food we're used to, and I love how light this one feels.
Yeah, and one of the goals that the founders had, Yang, Wanteng, and Ming, from the beginning, was creating a type of food that people could eat every day without too much guilt or thinking too badly about it. And then, of course, Lucas is also interested in all the exciting pop-ups and events and stuff, but basically his mentions of seeming like Chipotle and other places are correct, because we're trying just to do a very accessible, easy format, and then, you know, take a step forward with the food in terms of what do people of our generation, what's something that they would feel comfortable eating every day as a quick lunch between work or classes or whatever. So that's driven a lot of the constraints of what we have to work within.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you're talking so that I can eat while you're talking. Yeah, I mean, it does feel like something you can eat every day. Like, it doesn't feel heavy after you eat it, or it's delicious.
Of course, we're not recommending people to eat this every single day, but some people do, and we don't try to stop them.
Yeah, it's delicious. So you have all these interesting ingredients. People get to choose all these toppings, and with the Bings, people get a sauce on top as well at the end, right? And then it gets wrapped up.
Yeah, yep. Noodle sauce goes on in the beginning, and then for the Bing wraps, it goes on at the end.
Great. So one of the other things I found really interesting about your restaurant is every time I've gone in there, I meet another person who says, I'm part of the creative team. And after a while, I think I met 5 or 6 different people who said they were part of the creative team. And I thought, this is this new small startup restaurant. How do they have so many people on their creative team? So tell me about this amazing team of people you have.
Right. Well, one of the main differences between us and other restaurants was the team structure from the beginning. And our CEO, Yang, knew or planned that this would be more than one store from the beginning. So he started with a team that one store cannot necessarily afford, but similar to other startup models, you know, hoping for a fast enough growth to get to a spot where we can handle this bulky management team. But of course, that has given us access to creative people and resources that usually a tiny restaurant team, it's very, very difficult for them to pull off. You know, oftentimes it's one person handling every aspect of the store, and they do a great job, but there's just certain things that you can't give enough time or attention to if you're having to run around the store constantly. So in that regard, it's been helpful to have a few specialists on the team, both on the food end and then also on the creative end. But definitely not a team of a typical restaurant team, because none of us really had any restaurant experience before starting this off. You know, Lucas was doing his pop-up series in the Yale dorms, and, you know, Eva had run a little lunch spot back in northern China. But aside from that, we were all just kind of jumping in this for the first time, and that also gave us probably a different perspective on how to approach certain problems than other people who are used to the conventional wisdom might have. Not that that's necessarily been better at this point, but it's definitely made us a little different in some ways.
So you've been sort of figuring out the food line production piece a little bit as you go. And then in terms of you kind of started this as more like you'd start a software company.
Yeah, we start
in terms
of
getting investment and being able to sustain.
Yeah, a lot of our early planning came during a fellowship at the YEI, the Yale Entrepreneurial Institute. So that connected us with a bunch of advisors and resources that exposed us to a new type of thinking in terms of how we might start this and how we might try to grow it in the future. So everything we've been doing now, we've considered as a foundation of something that we can build upon in the future. Not necessarily something that just stays in New Haven. Of course, we need to figure out what's the right way to grow without losing some of the aspects of the restaurant that we think are special. So that's always a challenge moving forward, but it's been great this first year to have some good feedback for some of the things that we're doing. So that's encouraging.
Yeah. So one of the things that is amazing about what you're doing is the marketing and the graphics and stuff of that you have in the restaurant. For example, your takeout menu is like a little newspaper. Who did this?
Yeah. I mean, that's myself, Lucas, doing some of the thinking, and then our designer and co-founder, Ming Bai. She got an MFA at the Yale Art School in graphic design. So, and then she, before that, she got another MFA in Beijing at the Central Academy? The Central something. But she brings an awesome style to all the messages and all the communications for events and projects. And she always tries to work in, you know, a lot of hand-drawn calligraphy styles into our menu. And, you know, we still accept that we're a restaurant. We need to have a menu. We need to have food and walls, but we're always trying to think what's some interesting way to approach those forms. You know, a menu, how can we maybe expand the information in that by adding a few more pages, making it seem like a newspaper? And then what's some exciting stuff we can put in there that is still relevant, but is maybe a little different or deeper than you might typically expect in a fast food restaurant.
Right. So you have this highly educated, highly talented team, and it seems like this is sort of a first creative endeavor together in this. And so there's like this amazing inspiration.
Absolutely. I mean, we work in pretty close quarters and everybody has a hand in every single project. So
yeah, I was kind of curious about kind of what's the creative process and decision-making process. You have 9 or 10 people on the team?
There's about 8 or 9 managers in the office, or 6 or 7 managers in the office, and then a kitchen staff of 20-ish, 20, 25. I mean, currently, because it's just been this one restaurant in one location, it's just been, you know, it's small enough that everybody can just sit in a room and talk things out and figure things pretty rapidly. We understand that might get a little trickier. We're opening up a New York spot, so we'll have to be back and forth, and we'll have to grow up a little bit in some of our communication styles to each other. Mm-hmm. But so far, the craziness and the intimacy has led and made some of these projects possible.
What are you thinking about that, Lucas?
No, absolutely, yeah. It's odd that a chef of a restaurant is willing to be engaged in every aspect of the business. I mean, it's important for me personally, as sort of a young graduate, to learn everything from accounting to marketing strategies to basic operational things. And that's only possible on top of doing the creative things that are part of my job. With a group of people that are so sort of like excited about the possibilities of Gen Z as a kitchen and as a starting port, or at least a platform to express whatever they're interested in.
Right. And so to sustain this enormous team you have, you guys did a lot of fundraising in advance of, like, where did the money come from? I mean, most small businesses start and they're like scraping by every penny to pay like 4 people, you know? And so this is such a different model.
Yeah, we started off with support from family and friends, and now with the New York expansion, we're moving into a somewhat more formal fundraising round with outside investors. None of that is finally, you know, is finished yet, but we're in the process of, this has been a good prototype, the New Haven store,
right?
A good example of what we could do in New York, in the Northeast and beyond. So it's been a good year of getting some evidence of what we're up to.
I mean, in terms of funding, it's odd for us because we're also demonstrating to investors and people who are willing to support us that we're actually not doing things the way typical restaurants are doing things. So it takes a bit of work, mostly from Reed and from Young, our CEO, to convince people that, hey, this is worth your time, this is worth your investment. This seems a little loony, but give us a little while and things might come together.
Yeah. Loony is often where the good stuff comes. So let's talk about some of the loony stuff.
Yeah.
So night lunch is part of it. So you described kind of your regular sort of lineup where people come in and choose what they want off the assembly line. But then at night, you've got a whole other thing going on. Tell us about that.
So night lunch is a word that Reed found that I think he can tell us about.
Yeah. So when we first started off, I was digging through the Yale Daily News archives doing some research on early Chinese restaurants in New Haven around the late 1800s. And then in the, a lot of the advertisements and business listings in the papers back then, there were also other food carts that described themselves as night lunch wagons. One of them was the first iteration of Louis Lunch. So that was a word that kind of just stuck in our head, and we did a little digging, and we realized that night lunch was basically a term to describe any casual late night quick bite. And that was usually in night horse-drawn wagons called night lunch wagons that after the bars closed, everybody would go there to get, you know, a chicken pot pie, coffee, yeah. cake, ham sandwich.
Boiled eggs.
Boiled eggs, fried oysters, something simple. So we were that was kind of the context that we envisioned this nighttime series, just because near our restaurant and Yale campus, there's so much nighttime activity. So we definitely knew we wanted to do something to complement that. So that was a word that we became obsessed about, night lunch. And then Lucas, when he was an undergrad at Yale, he was already running this whole pop-up series called Why Pop-Up. So he knew that he wanted to do something that gave him creative freedom and he can experiment with new ingredients and techniques and collaborate with new people. So we basically combined the two of those, and it's been both an exciting place for our daily customers to come hang out at night and try a little thing different from our culinary team, but it's also been a space for Lucas and the team to experiment with new things and just work on stuff that actually excites them. Sometimes the bings and noodles can become a little routine for the culinary team.
Yeah. So go ahead, tell us a little about what you've done for night lunch.
And I mean, when we started doing night lunch, like the plan actually was that we would close the restaurant at 9 and then we would open again at 10. And somehow I would, in that hour, I would have put together 100 portions of anything. And it would change every single week. And the first time we did like yams. And then we did sort of like sliders. We did fried rice. It was ridiculous. Every single week we would come up with something different and we just serve it to people. And 5 minutes before service started, I would explain to the rest of the kitchen staff, hey, this is what we're doing. This is how it's going to go down. So that was ridiculously exciting. And somehow we've stumbled along that sort of like whatever night lunch, the night lunch culinary philosophy was supposed to be. And we've arrived at sort of what we're working on now, which is in effect a sort of homage to American Chinese food. Parts of it is. And parts of it are, that's exactly what it is. It's an homage to the American Chinese food. So, I mean, some of our most popular items right now on our menu are General Chu's chicken. So Chu is the name of our store manager, and we just named this dish after him because his name sounds like General Chow's chicken.
And we eat a lot of fried chicken.
And we eat a lot of fried chicken. And the
so
one
this
thing,
is a play on General Tso's chicken, I which everybody
so,
knows.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
but again, you're doing it a little different.
Yeah, so it's, in effect, it's chicken battered, fried, and then tossed in sort of some like sticky, sweet, and sour sauce. That really is what the variation sort of comes down to. So that's what we did. And as the way I learned, I never went to culinary school, but the way I learned how to cook was just bounce around kitchens. Every single kitchen I've ever worked in, no matter what country, people always spoke the common tongue of fried chicken. It's everybody's favorite food, like without a doubt. It's the only thing that brings people together in times of hardship in the kitchen. So, and one of my most important chefs to me ever in Seattle told me, hey, if you want to become the best in the world, right? Like if this is what, this is how you're going to define yourself. He was a baker. So he said, you have to make the best eclair. If you eat an eclair that you made and you tell yourself this is the best eclair I've ever had and you've succeeded and you know how to make one thing and then you move on to the second one. I was like, okay. So I did that for fried chicken, right? When I was like a sophomore in college, like was running this pop-up in the basement of my dorm and I made this fried chicken. I was like, oh, this is the best fried chicken ever. And we basically used that same recipe from, what is it now, 4 or 5 years ago for every single time we make fried chicken at Staff Lunch Kitchen. So the kids love it. Management loves it. We're like, okay, let's put it on the menu. Put it on the menu. I like, give my secrets to like two line cooks. Like, this is how you do it. This is why this is important.
Yeah.
And then we come up with a sauce. We toss it in the sauce. We put it on rice. Rice comes with a scrambled egg, and that became their General Tso's chicken with rice on the late night menu. Another thing we have is a mala instant noodle. So everyone in college, everywhere in the college town, and everybody likes to eat instant ramen. But instant noodles also has a sort of very specific spot in sort of the culinary legends of Hong Kong, Hong Kong. Like every day from, I would go to church and leave church when I was a kid, and then we would always get instant noodles at a restaurant, and it was always the best thing. So it's like, okay, how do we do that?
I didn't know that any restaurants in absolutely. China were it's, serving
it's like,
instant
it
noodles.
It might be our national dish in Hong Kong. Like, it really, it's spam, a perfectly fried egg, and just like al dente, not even
Did
al dente.
Did you say with spam?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Seared spam. Here we toss our beef in like a sort of grassy sauce. Obviously, the key to the instant noodles is that you make your own broth. Mm-hmm. There's something nice about plasticky. Sort of like just
it's like the
soft.
Junk food yeah.
Exactly.
Junk food like home cooked
so you
food
don't
mix.
Want to mess
you're
with that
to, you're
but you
to get that.
Do want to elevate the stock a little, so we make a stock out of like chicken backs and pork and stuff,
yeah,
and then we make it spicy, ton of spices that goes in with noodles and beef, and then another runny egg on top, and then that's sort of a meal. So we were bumbling around, but like those are some of the things we have managed to hit for night lunch.
Yeah.
And truly I like felt like we're almost there to like capture the spirit of sort of being restless and like eating a very specific type of college food as a new type of American Chinese restaurant.
Yeah. I don't even think it's just college food. It's sort of like comfort food, you know,
yeah.
For
I mean,
everybody. But
we open at
10:30,
so it needs to be a little greasy. It needs to be a little sort of self-indulgent. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. So one of the things that is really interesting about night lunch is that it's not just you and the mm-hmm. other people who are the chefs, the management chefs, but you're working with your line cooks who are like 20-year-old, just people from New Haven,
yeah.
right? Who maybe have cooked a little before, maybe haven't
right.
really cooked before, and they're involved in creating this menu. So tell me a little bit about that process. That's really different than what most
it's
places
It's important. Do. I mean, it's important to recognize as many fun things as we like to do at Zhenzi. At the end of the day, we are a fast food restaurant, which means in terms of labor, you're working with kids that work at Dunkin' Donut shops, and then they come here and you have to tell them, hey, we're going to make this Chinese food, and Chinese food is a little complicated. You know, if you're pressing the bings, there's dough manipulation that you learn for years at culinary school or whatever. There's stir-fry technique. There's like all these things that you actually have to pay attention to. We have recipes, yes, but because of the speed and the way Chinese food works, like it's a lot of tasting and experience that I'm going to demand of you. But that's not to say that in a place like New Haven, in a place with fast food workers the way they are, we shouldn't be able to do that. So it's critical and really, really important to me that these kids understand that concept and they're willing to take on the challenge.
Right. So the first thing is that you're hiring people who have like minimal
right.
skill,
yeah.
but you're not asking them to just come in and stick something in a microwave like
right.
they would have to do
yeah.
at a When you say fast food, you're like fast, fresh food, which I think is a little
yeah.
different than fast food, right? And so you're asking them to come in and kind of take the first step
yeah.
into learning some
yeah.
culinary skill.
Yeah.
They have to chop things. They have to press dough. They have to
because we have yet
cook.
To
they're
invent.
Actually cooking.
Yeah, they're actually cooking because we haven't gotten around to inventing the robots to replace that yet. So
and hopefully you won't. That's
yeah,
not the point.
Yeah, absolutely. So they go through this sort of like long. Somewhat relative to their other jobs at Dunkin' Donuts, it's a arduous training process to learn all these things. But still, because we're serving primarily the same things every day, I imagine some of them might get bored. I certainly would. That's no reason to keep them around. So,
right.
And even if their background is in Dunkin' Donuts, that doesn't mean they don't have. Some of them don't have culinary aspirations. A couple of kids who have sort of like. Let through, hey, one day I imagine running a Filipino food truck. Or one day Omar says, hey, I would love to run a little like empanada stand, but they're 17, 18 years old and like no idea where to go. This is like maybe their second or third job. The question is like, how do you align those aspirations of theirs to our own sort of like business?
Right.
So we were doing a table that internally we were calling Chef's Table for a while. That was a sort of 3-to-5-course tasting menu on Wednesdays in our restaurant. So everyone else was getting takeout, but then people would sit down with like proper heavy plates and whatever and eat sort of this 3-to-5-course meal. And every single time we did that on Wednesdays, the guest chef would be Sometimes it was a friend of mine, but more often than not, it was an employee. So Omar, for instance, his mother used to bring in these empanadas for staff lunch. And so everybody loves them. So he's like, hey, I'm going to do my own empanada. I'm going to smoke my own ham. I'm going to do this cheese thing. And then he makes these empanadas and that's the first course. And two days before, I'm sitting down talking to him, asking him, hey, what's the thing that you really want to show people? Like, what's a food from home? He's like, oh, I have this thing. I have this rice dish. I was like, okay, but like, what happens if we take this to the next level? And then slowly through a process like that, we coax out this 3 to 5 course menu. That's a little interesting, but it's not without technique. So in just a week's working with these kids, like Omar's learned a bunch of technique that can be sort of like cooking technique, basic stuff.
Right, so you're
like,
drawing on their personal inspiration, their personal experience, and then you're sort of helping to infuse some new techniques into it. And are you also merging some Chinese cuisine
sometimes
flavors into it sometimes staying authentic if it's like Ecuadorian food or like an African-American traditional
whatever.
Food or
speaking of African-American traditional food, one of my favorite I shouldn't say one of my favorite employees, but one of my favorite kids, Ernie, I get into this habit of calling everybody kids, but Ernie's 34 years old. He's an amazing cook, and we were hanging out and coming up with his chef's table. His last course was a lemon cake. So I was like, hey, what do you need for this lemon cake? He was like, okay. I said, I have flour, I have sugar, I have everything here in the store. I can make you lemon cake. I know how to make cake. He's like, no. He's like, you're not going to make lemon cake like that. He's like, go to Ferrero's, go to the cake aisle. Cake aisle. And then he's like, get the cheapest box of lemon cake. I was like, oh, they have nice stuff here too. Like, no, get the cheapest. I want store brands. We get Best Buy. And we get Best Buy lemon cake. We come down. He makes an icing out of sugar and 7-Up.
Mm-hmm.
He pours that on top of this box of lemon cake. He's like, this is what it means to Ernie's lemon cake. This is what Ernie's lemon cake is. I'm not going to put 5 spice powder in that. To make that a Chinese thing. Absolutely. It is perfect as a storytelling vehicle. So there's that. But sometimes some kids, like Chris recently, was like, hey, I'm interested in Chinese food. I make Filipino food at home. I'm wondering, how do we take this into sort of a Chinese level? I read about these bao things. How do we, do you think
like
we can serve that for
bun.
Night lunch? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, oh, cool. There's an equivalent in the Philippines. How do we put them together? Like, what can we learn from both of them? And how do we put this out? So depends. Yeah.
Right. So you're really giving people an opportunity that otherwise they don't have. Yeah. I think this is like a very, very innovative part of what you guys do as a restaurant, because I've worked in the food industry for over 10 years and then had 10 more years as a food activist. And, food jobs can be the most demeaning, one of the most food, restaurant jobs and agriculture jobs are two of the most exploited jobs. And not only because people's rights are abused, but also because they can be really monotonous and really boring, and you can be working in really bad conditions. And often owners can be really disrespectful to workers. And so the fact that you guys are, both from your own personal inspiration and because of how you want to treat your workers, are giving people opportunities to be themselves, show up like with their full selves at work is a pretty big deal. And to have some creative opportunity to help create a menu that's going to be served to the public, like as your first or second job, is a really big deal. Like, most people don't get that until they're a sous chef, which they might have worked many years to work up to that level.
The other thing I realize is the traditional kitchen system doesn't teach you the skills that you need to become sous chef or chef as a leader until you get to that point, which is why culinary school teaches you everything you need to be a line cook. All your first jobs are going to teach you to become excellent line cooks, but once anyone asks, hey, would you like to open your own spot, or hey, what should we put in this menu, hey, can you juggle these supplies, taste this, make sure it's correct, it's not the chef taste, it's your taste buds, like all those skills. It's important to me that they sort of get, if they don't learn them, at least to be exposed to that sort of technique, and to take it upon themselves to then sort of like add it to their own repertoire as they maybe hopefully look for jobs at other places.
Yeah. And do they get involved in some of the pricing stuff as well? Do they have to think about
some of our kids like look at this, do order our food from our suppliers. They do the inventory. They tell other cooks, other people in the team what to make when. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then not only are they getting to do this, but you guys put their posters of them up on the wall in your restaurant, which is like kind of a cool thing. Tell me a little about that.
Their posters?
Yeah, well, basically for every event we've been doing, our artist Ming has created some sort of usually 5-foot long rice paper poster with colorful illustrations and a basic menu about it. And a lot of these previous events where we featured some of the Junzi crew, that was just an exciting way to position the event, was that it's not just this menu, but this is also, you know, one of our crew stepping up into the spotlight and, you know, flexing some of their skills and techniques. And that's just as much a reason that we're excited about it, and that's just enough as much a reason for us to have this event as it is for our customers to have a fun dining experience.
Right. Yeah.
So,
and they're fun posters.
No,
like
totally,
they add,
totally.
They're humorous and they've got people's pictures on them. And
it's not, I mean, every restaurant in New Haven has some crew of people with skills and creativity. You know, it's not like we are different in that regard. We've been finding different ways to present that creativity and skills that's already just existing in our store as it is.
Right.
So this is something that, you know, any other restaurant can do, is figure out a cool way to feature their employees, to push their skills in a way that benefits the restaurant by, okay, your team is getting better and better and better. And some of them will leave to go on to different positions, but that gives you a good reputation, and still some people will want to stay in the system and, you know, contribute to you and grow and grow. So, you know, we'd love for some of our staff to outgrow us and start their own food truck or whatever and become an owner operator and help on the local scene. You know, that's like a charming part of our legacy. We'd love to be able to help people like that in the future, but we'd also love them to stick with us and keep growing this and do cooler and cooler things.
Yeah. I'm curious, as you're talking about this, like, and some of the people who are managers at Junzi went to Yale. And so part of what you're talking about is a kind of community building here that's based on people developing relationships and giving each other respect. And in New Haven, like I think many towns where there's a really predominant college, there's often a struggle between kind of the college population and then the community population that's not part of the college. And
right.
Haven, that's certainly a huge tension where we have,
absolutely,
like, we have really high rates of poverty. We have just the culture outside of Yale is very different from the culture inside of Yale. And there's sort of an intentional divide sometimes by the university to kind of keep some things separate, sometimes not so intentional.
No, absolutely.
And I think all of us struggle with that. And I'm sort of curious in terms of the way that you're running the restaurant, like, do you intentionally think about that, and kind of how do you perceive that tension, and how are you trying to work with that?
Totally. I mean, a big part of the team is from Yale. A big part of the team is not from Yale. I'm from UConn. Our store manager, Andrew, is from Southern. A bunch of the rest of the kitchen team grew up in New Haven. Some people went to Gateway. So that the team itself just naturally has all these different viewpoints coming together. And I mean, myself personally, from coming from outside Yale, I've been aware of how non-Yalies see it and what are some of the, you know, messages or vibes that a place can send that maybe not on the surface says it, but kind of subterranean can say you're not welcome and feel a little too exclusive to Yale community. So all the events we're trying to do, we're always challenging ourselves to, okay, definitely this needs to be exciting for the Yale campus community because that's just where our store is located. We're right there. But how can this also be an exciting thing and something that other people just feel welcome at who are not necessarily a Yale student? So how are the 20-something? I mean, we're primarily a younger-focused restaurant because we are a college community. So more so we do have a cute, youthful vibe, but still we want any resident, any economic status to feel comfortable coming in, buying a $5 wrap and still have a nice, simple, quick lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always challenging ourselves to how can we do things that bring together these people, not necessarily in a way that's just us trying to feel fuzzy, super community, save the world vibes. I mean, we're a fast food restaurant. How could we do something that just naturally people get excited about and want to spend their Saturday night at?
Yeah. And another thing that I think you're doing that sort of helps in the community is some of the sustainability things you're doing around food sourcing and around paper products and stuff, which is important given global warming and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Our CEO, Young, and our operations director, Wan Ting, they both graduated from the Yale Forestry School. So they started this business with a lot of that knowledge base in mind. So, you know, we don't make any claims that we are super sustainable or better than other restaurants. I mean, but there are some, they're always trying to make steps toward that. And it's not something I think that's a yes or no, we are sustainable, we're not. It's always a struggle to keep adding in more things, keep learning more things, improving our process. But definitely simple things like, yeah, compostable packaging. I mean, partnering with New Haven Farms, they bike over to our place every week to pick up our compost. For our pop-up events especially, it's easier because that's a smaller scale that Lucas can work with local farms like Massaro or Walden Hill and, you know, source their items. So where we can, we're always trying to make steps toward that. But the challenge, of course, also is, you know, we are a fast food restaurant. We need to sell a certain amount of product, and not always can local farms supply us with that on that scale reliably.
Right. You don't have a seasonal menu. You have kind of an all-year-round menu. Has that been challenging for you to source local food?
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it's frustrating that kale comes in and you're just like, oh, I want the kale that Steve grows, right? Mm-hmm. But between that sort of like personal struggle and we do try to at least move into some sort of seasonality with our menu to reflect whatever is in season, as well as what makes sense to eat given that season. So slowly we're making steps towards that.
Which is now just changing up a few of the hot vegetables every few months. Yeah. The meats and the grain bases stay the same, but it's a little easier to shift up a few different vegetables, you know, white yams or cauliflower this month, and then cabbage a few months later.
So I suppose it just falls into our broader sort of Gen Z sort of business philosophy, which is to basically really look into the details and look at every single thing that a typical restaurant has, and just to improve them element by element. If the menu is a good platform for giving people more information about the state of Chinese food, then let's make it sort of bigger and make it into a newspaper. If we have an empty restaurant Wednesday evenings, like, why not like put the employees out there and have them put out a menu?
Right.
If we have these vegetables that, you know, if we have a set number of bins to fill with vegetables, why not look at when cauliflower is a good time to eat and when it's a good time to eat? Like, when is a good time to start pickling your cabbage?
Right.
Whatever.
That's great. Well, thank you guys for joining me. I really appreciate it. I think that your restaurant is really inspiring. And as I said, the things that I see you doing with your menu, the fun night menu, and in raising up the talents of the cooks is a really special thing. And I'm pretty excited that you're going to New York City. I think this is going to be a huge, huge hit in New York.
Yeah, we're super excited. We'll see where it goes. But this first year has definitely been a great start.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Deegan.
You're listening to WNHH Radio, 103.5 FM in New Haven, streaming live at newhavenindependent.org. This has been The Table Underground, and I'm your host, Tegan Engel. See you in 2 weeks.